1982 in review. The Audio Network of United Press International presents a documentary in sound, the major news events of the year. You'll hear history in the making and the voices of those who made the headlines on 1982 in review. '82 is a year that saw economic problems both at home and abroad. A change in the Soviet leadership following the death of President Leonid Brezhnev.
The new head of the Soviet Communist Party is Yuri Andropov, who stepped down as chief of the KGB only a few months ago. His election was announced after a meeting of the Central Committee, where he was nominated by his rival, Konstantin Chernenko. Andropov is said to be a technocrat. He enjoys the support of the army and the foreign policy establishment, which see him as a tough opponent to the Reagan administration.
A tough stand by President Reagan as his administration prepared to deal with the new Soviet hierarchy.
It's going to require some action, not just words. For 10 years, detente was based on words from them and not any deeds to back those words up. And we need some action that they... It takes two to tango, that they want to tango also.
There was more turmoil in the Middle East with the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the massacre of two Palestinian refugee camps in Beirut.
It was a scene that was truly horrible. There were just dozens and dozens of bodies lying about in the wreckage of their homes, men, women, and children piled up on top of one another. Some of them were already covered by dirt and chunks of concrete. Bulldozers had been through, and they tried to push the wreckage of the people's homes on top of the bodies, possibly to hide them from prying eyes. But there were too many bodies, and there was no way to hide all of that.
1982 also saw the introduction of martial law in Poland and hostilities over a tiny group of islands in the South Atlantic.
Britain and Argentina moved suddenly from being distant friends with a long-standing disagreement over the Falkland Islands, which they'd never been able to settle, to adversaries teetering on the brink of all-out war.
I'm Nick Charles.
And I'm Patrice Sikora.
A look at the year in retrospect on 1982 in review. The economic problems that plagued the United States during 1981 spilled over into 1982 and were very much evident throughout most of the year. But there was room for optimism. In January, the Labor Department announced the total inflation rate was held to 8.9% in 1981, the smallest increase since 1977. In 1982, the rate was almost halved. Interest rates were also starting to fall, but the unemployment figures continued to go up. Labor reporting in April that the jobless rate was 9%, the highest in 7 years, with nearly 9.9 million people out of work. By December, the figure swelled to 10.8%, the highest in 42 years. President Reagan, anxious to do something about the jobless problem, said he was considering as an alternative to the Democratic-sponsored jobs program a public works reconstruction plan. His idea to raise federal gasoline taxes by 5 cents. The money to be used to finance a bridge and highway rebuilding program, which in turn would create jobs. But he insisted it would not violate an earlier pledge not to raise taxes.
It would be a user fee. It would be dedicated to the rebuilding of our highways and bridges. This is a problem that must be met sooner or later.
The proposal had powerful Republican backing. 1982 also saw the Social Security system in trouble and debate on its future. On August 19th, Congress passed what turned out to be the largest tax hike ever, and this during an election year recession. Supply-siders fought the president's $98 billion tax hike proposal bitterly. Republican Ed Bethune of Arkansas said it would not work.
You can't get economic growth and balanced budgets by raising taxes. Congress won't use new tax money to reduce the deficit. It'll just spend it.
A coalition of Democrats and loyal Republicans argued back that the increase would cut the deficits. House Speaker Tip O'Neill lectured young Republicans about political, not economic debt.
You're here because Reagan. You're here because he was elected President of the United States. He brought you to the Congress of the United States, and now we're on the eve of an election. And he's asking for a change of policy. Are you going to follow the leader that brought you here? Or are you going to run? I ask you to think of that.
But a majority of Republicans and Democrats did follow the leader, and the bill passed. During the November elections, the Democrats scored gains, expanding their majority by 26 seats in the House. But the Senate makeup remained the same. The stock market took off like a rocket during the summer of 82 and didn't let up. Robert Cohen reports record high volume was registered on October 7th and surpassed a month later. The Dow Jones Industrials also soared to the highest point ever.
October 6th, lower interest rates kept the summer-autumn rally bandwagon rolling and the Dow Jones Industrial soared 37 points. The next day, traders plunged the market into a frenzy. Some 147 million shares were traded, topped only by activity on November 4th. Investors voted for lower rates on November 3rd, and the market posted a record gain of more than 43 points, soaring to its highest level ever, 1,065.49, an advance of 277 points since the rally began in mid-August. Robert Cohen, New York.
November 11, 1982, the official Soviet news agency TASS made the announcement. President Leonid Brezhnev, who presided over the Soviet Empire for 18 years, was dead at the age of 75, the victim of a heart attack. This is part of an English language broadcast announcing Brezhnev's death.
The Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR, and the Council of Ministers of the USSR deeply regret to announce the sudden death on November the 10th, 1982, at 8:30 in the morning, of the General Secretary of the Central Committee and the Chairman of the Presidium of the USSR Supreme Soviet, Leonid Brezhnev.
Brezhnev, who took over the government reins from Nikita Khrushchev in 1964, was in power longer than any other Soviet leader, with the exception of Joseph Stalin, and he turned his nation into a military superpower to rival the United States. It did not take very long before the communist leaders named Yuri Andropov as General Secretary of the Communist Party to succeed Brezhnev. Andropov served for 15 years as head of the Soviet secret police, the KGB. President Reagan chose not to attend Brezhnev's funeral, but instead sent Vice President Bush and Secretary of State Shultz to head the U.S. delegation. Kirsten Lundberg was at Red Square during the solemn ceremony, attended by hundreds of foreign dignitaries.
Solemn music and gray skies mark the Red Square funeral of President Leonid Brezhnev. Thousands of Soviet citizens joined soldiers, foreign dignitaries, and the Soviet leadership in putting Brezhnev's body to rest. Yuri Andropov, who became Communist Party boss after Brezhnev, delivered the first funeral tribute, followed by Defense Minister Dmitry Ustinov. The huge square was bare of any decoration. Only handheld portraits of Brezhnev, edged in red and black, added a touch of color to the drab scene of mourners. This is Kirsten Lundberg in Moscow.
You're listening to 1982 in Review.
The Middle East continued to be a powder keg in 1982. Philip Habib, the U.S. Middle East emissary, made several trips to Israel, Egypt, Lebanon, and Syria in efforts to stop the fighting between Israel and PLO guerrillas in Lebanon. Ceasefires were arranged and then broken time and time again. And then, during the first week in June, Israeli troops invaded Lebanon, moving to the gates of Beirut. Vincent Shadolsky reports the PLO leadership was trapped inside Lebanon's capital city.
Israel's sweep through the southern half of Lebanon has been swift, and its siege of Beirut is now complete. Despite fierce battles with the Palestinians in their strongholds in the south, the Israelis had little trouble in overcoming the guerrilla fighters. One after one, the Palestinian-controlled cities of the south came under Israeli control. Israel is now able to move the bulk of its forces up to the Beirut area, having secured a corridor all the way from its northern border to the Christian-controlled eastern half of the capital. Vincent Shadolsky, Beirut.
President Reagan sent a message to Israeli Prime Minister Begin demanding the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Lebanon. But Begin ignored the U.S. and subsequent U.N. demands for a ceasefire, and his forces, numbering 25,000, consolidated their grip on nearly one half of Lebanon. Israeli jets knocked out all of Syria's missile sites based in Lebanon, a thorn in Begin's side for over a year. In the process, 23 Syrian MiGs were shot down in dogfights. Eventually, Israeli troops moved into Beirut and sealed off all air, sea, and land routes. The PLO guerrillas had their backs against the wall with no alternative, either agree to evacuate or be flushed out. On August 6th, after days and days of negotiations mediated by American emissary Philip Habib, an agreement was reached with the PLO on a withdrawal plan. 4 days later, Brooke Kroger reported the Israelis also agreed to go along with the proposal.
The formula involves deployment of a multinational force with 300 French troops in place before the withdrawal begins to work with Lebanese army units in taking over fortified facilities once the PLO abandons them. Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and Sudan are said to have agreed to take substantial numbers of the PLO fighters. The multinational force will involve 800 Americans, 800 Frenchmen, and 400 Italians. Brooke Kroger, Tel Aviv.
On September 18th, the world was shocked to hear that hundreds of Palestinians were massacred at two refugee camps in Beirut over a two-day period.
We had children coming into the hospital yesterday. One small boy, who's now at the American hospital, came in and said that the phalangists had kicked open the door and shot all his family in front of him, and he was the only survivor. And he said there was no reason for them to do that because they were just sitting in the house, afraid and terrified. We heard many horror stories.
And correspondent Walter Wisniewski reported that the Israeli-backed right-wing militia was being blamed.
Men, women, and children were gunned down methodically by a team of killers over a 36-hour period. Members of the militia of the right-wing Falange Party and the forces of pro-Israeli Major Saad Haddad were holding the camps during that time. The Israelis left the camps in the control of the right-wing Lebanese allies, who are avowed enemies of the Palestinians, despite complaints by U.S. diplomats. Bullet-punctured bodies are lying everywhere, in groups as large as 15 in some places. Men were lined up against the wall and executed, their bodies falling together in a heap. Not a soul was left alive after the killers swept through. Walter Wisniewski, Beirut.
The massacre stirred a massive international outcry. At first, Israeli Prime Minister Begin, who said he didn't learn of the massacre until 2 days after it started, said there would not be an investigation of the incident, but then backed down under international pressure and ordered a special panel to determine what part, if any, the Israelis had in the massacre.
On August 23rd, Bashir Gemayel was elected president of Lebanon, giving the people of that country new hope that he could bring stability to the war-torn country. But within 3 weeks, even before he was inaugurated, Gemayel was killed during a bombing attack at his Beirut party headquarters. Within a short period of time, the Lebanese parliament named Gemayel's brother Amin as the country's new president. Amin Gemayel, soon after taking power, called on the United States, Italy, and France to send troops to his country, peacekeeping forces to restore order. He also asked for the authority to rule by decree. The Lebanese parliament granted him 6 months.
Secretary of State Haig, who repeatedly had difficulty with various members of the Reagan administration during his year and a half in office, decided to resign his post on June 25th. Haig referred to growing differences over foreign policy in general and the Middle East in particular.
Under these circumstances, I feel it necessary to request that you accept my resignation.
President Reagan accepted Alexander Haig's resignation and nominated George Shultz to succeed him.
With great regret, I have accepted the resignation of Secretary of State Al Haig. I am nominating as his successor, and he has accepted George Shultz to replace him.
On July 15th, Shultz was confirmed as the new U.S. Secretary of State. You're listening to 1982 in Review.
Poland continued to have political and economic problems throughout most of 1982. A power struggle between the government and the trade union Solidarity brought Russian troops to the Polish border. Moscow was warned by the United States not to move within the borders. But while no troops entered Poland, the Soviets did exert pressure on the Warsaw government and martial law was imposed in Poland. But Edwin Smith reports in February, opposition to restrictions and repressions against Solidarity Union members brought about demonstrations and strikes against the government.
As the month of February began, Poles were trying to adjust to stinging price increases of 200%, 300%, or even 400% in the cost of most of the necessities of life. Street violence had broken out in the port of Gdańsk a few days before, and authorities cracked down hard. More than 160 demonstrators received summary sentences from martial law courts. The two-month anniversary of the imposition of martial law on the 13th prompted fresh disturbances in the western city of Poznan, and then scattered incidents of violence in several parts of the country. At the month's end, military strongman General Wojciech Jaruzelski told a Communist Party Central Committee meeting that his decision to impose martial law had avoided a world confrontation. And he said the regime would fight those who resisted and have declared themselves the enemies of socialism.
The crisis in Poland attracted international attention, and on February 23rd, Japan, Canada, and 10 European Community nations joined the United States in imposing economic and diplomatic sanctions against Poland and the Soviet Union to protest martial law in Poland. Demonstrations and protest action were frequent, especially in Gdansk, the hometown of labor leader Lech Wałęsa, where solidarity was born. Time and time again, there were confrontations between shipyard workers and police. Finally, Wałęsa was taken into custody, and a few months later, the Solidarity Trade Union and all existing labor organizations were outlawed. Ruth Gruber reports in November, after 11 months of internment, Wałęsa was released.
Lech Wałęsa's first formal encounter with the press was a puzzling performance in which the newly freed leader of the banned Solidarity Union sidestepped all questions dealing with his future or the possible resurrection of Solidarity. He said he met with a prosecutor general who went over the penal code with him, apparently showing him what penalties he would be liable to if he stepped out of line. Wałęsa reaffirmed commitment to the ideals behind Solidarity, but he hedged questions on whether he would fight for the banned union's restoration. This is Ruth Gruber in Warsaw.
Pope John Paul II, already the most traveled pope in history, added thousands and thousands of miles to his journeys, visiting Great Britain, Argentina, Africa, and Spain, where three men were arrested for allegedly plotting to assassinate him. He put off a trip to Poland because of the unrest in that country. On January 28th, anti-terrorist forces in Italy stormed an apartment in Padua to free American Army General James Dozier, the highest-ranking U.S. officer serving with NATO in Italy, who was held captive by leftist Red Brigade's terrorists for 42 days. Five of his captors were arrested.
Prior to 1982, not too many people heard about the Falkland Islands or even knew where they were located. But in April, the group of islands 400 miles northeast of the southern tip of South America made the headlines when more than 4,000 Argentine troops unexpectedly invaded that territory and began an occupation that wasn't to last very long. Britain broke diplomatic relations with Argentina and sent a naval force to the South Atlantic. The British sank the Argentine cruiser General Belgrano, and 2 days later, an Argentine missile sank the destroyer HMS Sheffield. The Argentine troops proved to be no challenge for the British, who took over South Georgia Island and then inched their way to Port Stanley, the capital of the Falklands. On the 14th of June, 74 days after Argentine troops began their occupation, the Union Jack was raised over Port Stanley. British Prime Minister Thatcher announced the surrender of the Argentine garrison to the House of Commons.
Our forces reached the outskirts of Port Stanley. Large numbers of Argentine soldiers threw down their weapons. They are reported to be flying white flags over Port Stanley.
That night, Argentine Commander Mario Menendez signed a formal surrender document ending the war over the Falkland Islands.
In October, there was fear in the home of every American after it was learned that seven Chicago-area residents died after taking cyanide-laced Tylenol capsules. Their deaths prompted a massive product recall by Johnson & Johnson, the makers of the painkiller.
We've taken steps to remove from Salem, Chicago area all extra-strength Tylenol capsules.
Thousands of bottles of Tylenol were removed from supermarket shelves and shipped to laboratories for testing. Illinois authorities found themselves involved in one of the largest law enforcement efforts in history to find the person or persons responsible. There were copycat incidents that followed the Tylenol scare involving eye drops, mouthwashes, and other over-the-counter products, prompting a government move requiring tamper-proof packaging on over-the-counter drugs. On December 2nd, doctors at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City implanted the world's first permanent artificial heart. The patient was Barney Clark, a 61-year-old retired dentist from Seattle. The operation was a success, and medical history was made.
In January, an Air Florida 737 carrying 71 passengers and five crew members crashed into a bridge while taking off from Washington, D.C. National Airport during a heavy snowstorm. Passenger Joe Stiley, who survived, said he sensed, during takeoff, that something was wrong.
I knew we didn't have the takeoff speed. I am a pilot. I have a lot of flight time, and I've flown in 737s quite a bit. I knew we were out of runway, and I knew when we reached that point, I knew we weren't going to make it.
78 people were killed, including four who were in their cars when the plane struck the bridge before falling into the Potomac River. In New Orleans in July, a Pan Am 727 jet crashed on takeoff. 153 people died in that crash.
The Space Shuttle Columbia was involved in three flights during 1982, in March, June, and November. Bob Honig covered all three.
Flights were the third through fifth in the shuttle program. The third flight in late March and early April proved a lot about the shuttle's usefulness. The fourth flight in late June and early July marked the completion of the shuttle's test phase. Flight 4 also landed on the 4th of July in a star-spangled ceremony with President Reagan in attendance. But it was Flight 5 from November 11th through 16th that saw the shuttle hit pay dirt.
3, 2, 1, and solid motor ignition and liftoff. Liftoff of the first operational space shuttle mission with two satellites on board, and the shuttle has cleared the tower.
The shuttle was indeed operational, carrying a pair of commercial communications satellites for paying customers for the first time. The satellites were launched flawlessly by Columbia's first four-man crew. There was a disappointment, though. The first spacewalk from the shuttle had to be called off when the $2 million spacesuits to be worn by astronauts Joe Allen and Bill Lenore developed problems. This is Bob Honig.
You're listening to 1982 in Review.
U.S. Senator Harrison Williams of New Jersey on February 16th was sentenced to 3 years in prison and fined $50,000 on charges of bribery and conspiracy in connection with the Abscam investigation. Less than 1 month later, Williams resigned from the Senate to forestall expulsion. On June 21st, a Washington jury found John Hinckley Jr., the man accused of trying to assassinate President Reagan in March of 1981, innocent by reason of insanity. After 4 days of deliberations, the jury said the prosecution had not proven that Hinckley was sane when he shot President Reagan and three others outside a Washington hotel. Jury foreman Lawrence Coffey said Hinckley's writings to actress Jodie Foster were a big factor in that final decision.
To me, all poetry is not fiction. There can be some truth into poetry, but not all poetry is not fiction.
Two female jurors later said they thought Hinckley was sane at the time of the shooting, but they were pressured to go along with the other panel members who said he was insane. Hinckley was sent to a Washington mental hospital. In Atlanta, Wayne Williams was found guilty of murdering two young black men and sentenced to two consecutive life terms. That trial stemmed from the murders of 28 people, mostly young black men, in the Atlanta area over a two-year period. Another court case that grabbed the headlines involved auto tycoon John DeLorean, a former vice president for General Motors, accused of being involved in a $24 million drug deal in an effort to save his financially ailing sports car firm in Northern Ireland. There were several governmental changes in 1982. Helmut Kohl taking over as chancellor in West Germany, replacing Helmut Schmidt. Miguel de la Madrid elected president in Mexico to succeed José López Portillo. On October 12th, Japanese Prime Minister Zenko Suzuki announced his resignation and was succeeded by conservative Yasuhiro Nakasone.
Hollywood and the rest of the world mourn the deaths in 1982 of several giants in the field of entertainment. Henry Fonda, who received an Academy Award a few months earlier for his role in On Golden Pond, died on August 12th at the age of 77 following a long illness. Fonda was also acclaimed for his parts in Mr. Roberts and The Grapes of Wrath.
And when the people are eating the stuff they raise and living in the houses they build, I'll be there too.
On August 29th, another film great, Ingrid Bergman, died at the age of 67 at her London home. She won three Academy Awards for Gaslight, Anastasia, and Murder on the Orient Express. But her role opposite Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca will be the one she will always be remembered for.
I don't understand. What about you?
I'm staying here with him till the plane gets safely away.
No, Richard, no. What has happened to you last night?
Last night we said a great many things. You said I was to do the thinking for both of us. Well, I've done a lot of it since then. It all adds up to one thing. You're getting on that plane with Victor where you belong.
But Richard, no, I...
You've got to listen to me. Have any idea what you'd have to look forward to if you stayed here? 9 chances out of 10, we'd both wind up at a concentration camp. Isn't that true, Louis?
I'm afraid Major Strasser would insist.
You're saying this only to make me go.
I'm saying it because it's true. Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it.
What?
Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, for the rest of your life.
But what about us?
On September 14th, the Cinderella story ended for Grace Kelly, the Hollywood star who went on to marry a prince. She died in Monte Carlo after being involved in a car accident.
1982 also said goodbye to actors Vic Morrow, Fernando Lamas, and Marty Feldman. Comedian John Belushi. jazz musician Thelonious Monk, TV personality Dave Garraway, country music star Marty Robbins, and Bess Truman, the widow of former President Harry Truman.
On June 21st, Britain's Prince Charles and Princess Diana became the proud parents of a baby, their first son and heir to the British throne. They named him Prince William.
1982 in review. A look at the year in retrospect, with the voices of those newsmakers who helped reshape the world we live in, and the major news events that will soon find their place in history. 1982 in Review was written and produced by Nick Charles. Narration by Nick Charles and Patrice Sikora. Technical supervision by Paul Sanchez. This has been a presentation of the UPI Audio Network. Peter Donnelly speaking. Thank you.